I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. If you watched TV last night, chances are good you saw a down and dirty brawl, and it wasn't on Sunday Night Football. It was the second presidential debate featuring Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump held in St. Louis. Today we'll hear reactions from a panel of local voters who say they haven't quite made up their minds about which candidate will get their vote. Then we'll take a look at three issues that will be facing Missourians on the ballot this year. Two that would raise taxes on tobacco products, and one that would strengthen voter ID regulations. As the saying goes, all politics is local on Up to Date after this hour's news. Good morning and welcome to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. I'm Steve Kraske. Millions tuned in last night to watch Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton duke it out in St. Louis. Some of us, meantime, are still trying to figure out exactly what we witnessed. And Missouri voters will face a bunch of ballot initiatives in November. Today, we'll take a close look at three of them that deal with tobacco taxes and voter ID laws. But first, teachers in Shawnee Mission have reached a tentative deal with the district after an impasse was declared back in August. Here to give us an update is KCUR's education reporter Sam Zeff. Sam, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
How about the update on what happened in the Shawnee Mission, Sam?
So last Thursday, they reached a tentative deal between the Shawnee Mission Teachers Union and the district. This was after two meetings with a federal mediator. They declared an impasse back in the summer. It doesn't really do much. It gives, in total, the district is putting 0.65% more into teacher salaries, so a bit more than a half percent. That will be retroactive to July. All teachers will get something, and this was a major sticking point when they went to an impasse. They're on different parts of the salary schedule. You may move up a couple of years, but there may be no additional money for that. You may be a teacher who doesn't have a master's degree, so you don't get additional money for that. The union was adamant that all teachers get a little something in this new contract.
You know, a little more than half of 1% strikes me as pretty modest. Why even have an impasse over something that small, Sam?
Yeah, very modest. In total, it's going to cost the district $2.9 million more. That's not very much in the Shawnee Mission School District. Mm-hmm. I think the teachers wanted to make sure that their people got something. The district is very, very hinky right now. All Kansas school districts are. They have no idea what the new school funding formula is going to look like.
I was going to say, state funding completely up in the air right now.
They have no idea what the state Supreme Court is going to do. So they're really flying blind in this. And I think there was resistance to even putting that much more into teacher salaries. But in the end, the teachers came out of that impasse, winning at least a little bit more money.
Yeah. How is this setting with some teachers, given that administrators got pretty big raises this year, Sam?
Well, I think they understand. Teachers certainly understand. Say they understand the problems with the state budget. I think they're less sanguine with what administrators have been getting. Just a few months ago, it was revealed that Jim Henson, who is the superintendent there, got a 9.5% pay raise. His pay went from $232,000 a year to $254,000 a year. Another example, Deputy Superintendent Kenny Southwick, he's essentially the district CFO, got a 15% pay hike from $169,000 to $195,000. The union says whatever new money comes into the district, they really want to make sure that more of that goes into teacher salaries, given all these big raises for administrators.
And Sam, the latest on the Kansas Supreme Court taking a look at school funding in Kansas, we expect a decision when, and what are the tea leaves telling you about what we might expect out of that ruling?
Well, it's hard to predict.
This is monumental stuff.
Yeah, it's hard to predict what the Kansas Supreme Court will do, but I'm going to guess that it's not going to happen before November 8th, the election. Five of these Supreme Court justices are up for retention. Four have been targeted by Republicans and conservatives. I don't think we'll see a ruling before before the election.
A little political there, it sounds like.
Absolutely. They're out there trying to they're worried about their jobs. There is a concerted effort to oust four of them. But I do think that we'll see a ruling before the legislature comes back in January. I think that the Supreme Court, they were hinting during oral arguments, that they will give the legislature perhaps the entire legislative session, and that may go into overtime. Susan Weigel was on State House Blend this weekend. She absolutely believes it's going past 90 days. But it sounds like I would be not surprised if the Supreme Court said, take the 90-day session, get this thing right, and let's move forward with a new formula.
That's the same Susan Weigel who's also hinting that she might be open to tinkering with the tax increases from a few years ago, the tax cuts from a few years ago, and see a change there.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that she absolutely would vote yay on closing the LLC loophole. Raising the marginal tax rates, though, I think that's going to be a little bit harder for conservatives, including Susan Weigel, to swallow.
That's KCUR, Sam Zuff. Sam, I always appreciate it.
Pleasure.
Among the millions watching last night's presidential debate was a panel of undecided voters from the Kansas City area. KCUR has asked them to watch each of the debates here and to give us their reactions afterwards. The first debate didn't seem to convince any of them to vote one way or the other, so let's see if last night's debate was any more convincing. Joining me here in the studio is Susan Wilson. She's vice chancellor for the Division of Diversity and Inclusion at UMKC. She's also a KCUR contributor. Susan, nice to have you back again.
Good to see you, Steve.
Remind us who makes up the panels that you've been working with here.
Well, if you'll recall, we set out trying to get truly undecided voters, and that was a difficult
task.
That's
a challenge, isn't it?
Because
most voters lean one way or the other.
Right, and especially because I think this election is different in that there's been some extreme polarization one way or the other. But making up our panel were there's a couple, Joe and Becky, who both have pro-life leanings, who are undecided. There are two African Americans, one Henry Lyons and the other Ina Montgomery. Henry has been a lifelong Republican. Ina is not excited about either candidates. And Craig, who was thinking about voting for Jill Stein, a Green Party candidate, but still undecided, and also another guy named Ron, who also is undecided.
We also want to hear from our listeners to join us here with their reactions as well to last night's big debate, the second debate. Did you get anything out of this forum? Did it shift your thinking about who you'll vote for? And what did you think of the spectacle of the whole thing? We'll be covering some specific points brought out during the debate. So tell us what you thought right now. 816-235-2888 is our phone number. Again, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. Well, Susan, there was definitely an elephant in the room last night, the videotape that came out Friday of Donald Trump talking about how his position as a star let him get away with inappropriate actions with women. I want to start with the panel's reactions to that.
Yeah, this is Rob Givens. I think the only thing it did was kind of raise the question in my mind about how he would deal with it, whether he would apologize or justify it or whatever. So not the content of the tape, but his response to it.
This is Craig. I didn't really see the significance of it, just because if you look at what he's been saying about women for the past year, this is no surprise.
This is Ina Montgomery. It was true Trump style. He did address it. You know, he didn't back down from it. He admitted that he said it. But he, I felt, as usual, minimized it just by saying it was just locker room talk. And as Hillary pointed out, not really giving a true, it appears, sincere apology for what he said.
Henry Lyons. And as far as the conversation, I challenge anybody in this room to go to any gym, bachelor party or bachelorette party, or to go to any bar that's having a sporting event, to be around any construction sites. I challenge anybody to say that some of those same conversations have not occurred. So to me, you do something that everybody else is doing, but you're the one that gets caught. So he just got caught.
Again, our phone number here for your reactions to that, 816-235-2888. Susan, I'm not sensing, interesting to me, any real outrage there. Did the rest of the panel have similar feelings, or what did you pick up?
Well, Steve, first of all, I think this whole topic generated a little bit of heat among people that we had last night, although you couldn't really tell from these particular responses. I think there were some people who felt very differently or reacted to Mr. Lyon's comment that, well, this is just locker room talk. Other people disagreed and said, well, these aren't the kind of guys I hang around. I haven't heard this before. Interesting, a couple of our focus group members said they didn't bother to watch the tape about the Access Hollywood incident because they said it's pure sensationalism and they didn't want to be swayed by that.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
The whole world seemed to be watching that tape, but they resisted it.
Yeah, that
like.
Really surprised me that they said, you know, that there's all this dirty tricks that lead up to campaigns and they just avoided it. But there was in the room some tension around the discussion of the Access Hollywood tape.
I can imagine. Let's go to some phone calls here from our listeners who are reacting to last night's second presidential debate. Let's go to Anton from Lawrence. Anton, you're on Up to Date. Nice to have you.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Go ahead.
Yeah, my general reaction to the political climate of this country is that we spend way too much time talking about trivial things like some obscene remark a candidate made, questioning each other's character and personality, when really we should just be talking about what is your political stance on this issue, and what are you going to do when elected to really deal with the problems facing this country and make it a better place.
You know, Anton, that's a really interesting point, but I'm wondering if you're the moderators of that debate last night, how do you avoid, as I mentioned, I think a few minutes ago, the elephant in the room here when it came to the release of that tape? You almost had to bring it up last night, didn't you?
I don't know. I mean, if you only have 90 minutes or so to give the people of the country an opportunity to decide who to vote for, I think time spent on those things is really time wasted, especially when you consider that the media had already covered that for, I mean, just wall-to-wall coverage in the days leading up to the debate. So I think everybody coming in already knew exactly what the issue was. And like I said, I just think it's a waste of time considering that we should be talking about actual political problems and what the candidates are going to do about them.
You know, last night I wrote an analysis for The Star about what went on last night during these 90 minutes. You know, close to half of the forum last night, close to half, 45 minutes was spent on the tape on Friday, various allegations of lies and innuendos and everything else. That's how much time got sucked up by this sideshow, in a sense, and not the issues that Anton's talking about. And Anton, you're saying that was way too much time.
Way too much time. And it's not just during that debate. I think just broadly speaking, media coverage of politics suffers from that exact problem. Rather than talking about what candidates are going to do, what their views are on positions, we talk about trivial things. We talk about their personality, some obscene statement that was made. And I think it's really just a waste of time.
And arguably, Anton, you know, voters say they're interested in issues, but a lot of times they're not. They don't want to read those stories. They don't want to listen to those stories on the air sometimes.
I don't think that's true. I think that's a very pessimistic view of politics. I think people in this country, especially people who are impoverished, you know, looking for work, concerned with political corruption, environmental degradation, I think we do want to actually hear substantive debates about the issues, and I think a lot of people, frankly, are tired of the triviality.
Anton, I'm glad you called. Thanks very much.
Thanks for taking my call.
Let's go to some. Yeah, go ahead, Susan.
I was going to say last night, I do think that some of our folks that were here last night said, yeah, we did spend a little bit too long on that, because this was the first debate, actually, I think, where some real key issues were discussed. The Supreme Court, the Affordable Care Act, taxes, energy policy. And I think people felt there really wasn't enough time to delve into those. I mean, certainly the debate covered them, But some of these are pretty complex when you're talking about healthcare reform and tax reform. There are complexities there that I think we weren't able to be delved into last night.
So bottom line, before I go back to some calls, we got a lot of them coming in here. How important was it to the focus group you had last night here in our studios, the tape that came out Friday? How important was that to how they were going about choosing a candidate here?
Well, I think at the end of the day, they said it didn't sway them one way or the other. Huh. Some people said, Craig mentioned, he said, well, this is pretty consistent. The tape is consistent with what we know about him already in various media leaks that have gone on. And other people, as I said, just didn't even watch it because they didn't feel that it was relevant to who they were going to vote for.
So people weren't surprised?
No, weren't shocked at all.
Back to some calls here. Mark from Kansas City, Missouri. Mark, you're on Up to Date. Nice to have you.
Thanks. I don't think it's a trivial issue at all. I think it is consistent with Donald Trump's character. Unfortunately, it's also consistent with the character of most of our public leaders. And I actually, you know, I'm torn about this because I really don't care. But if this is the way he treats women, this is also the way he's going to treat us. And, you know, we're his subjects if he wins. And to think that he would, you know, basically put his pleasure above people's rights isn't consoling or comforting. Now, that being said, I think that's the general problem with our political system. And I partly blame the media for basically reporting on horse race politics and not reporting on substantive issues.
Right.
And in the horse race politics, you know, we're all obsessed with, did he trip up? Is he going to make it? Is he not? We're really not looking at what this person is going to do to us when he has power.
And, Mark, you think that people will read those stories, they'll listen to those issue stories that you're talking about here? Because, again, the surveys that I've looked at in the past suggest people really don't, to a large measure.
Well, we have a problem that goes way back where the educational system in this country has been gutted and has produced an ignorant populace who don't understand civics. They don't even understand basic geography sometimes. And I think that's really the issue. We don't approach these political races from an educational point of view as much as we used to when I was a child. Mm-hmm. There was actually intelligent debate and equal time for opposing positions.
Mark, I appreciate that very much. Thank you. Yeah, Susan.
Well, and Steve, last night, I think even the people who were leaning toward Trump last night said, you know, they wanted to hear more from him about specifics because he was using a lot of pretty powerful words like disastrous and things like that. And they said, but that doesn't really give us a good idea about what he's going to do, although he did speak specifically about how he might change the tax law. I think everybody concluded last night they want to hear more specifics.
You also came up with some disagreements on the panel last night, Susan. Like what?
Well, I think certainly there were disagreements about whether or not a candidate's moral behavior should factor into a decision to vote for them or not. I think some of our couple who was pro-life started to like some of the things that Hillary had to say, but were really kind of stumped by, you know, the concern about the Supreme Court nominations and whether or not they'd be pro-life.
Let's listen to some of that disagreement.
What I'm looking for is how do I make a judgment about who to push a ballot for a couple of weeks from now? And in that regard, I don't think he acquitted himself well in minimizing or denying that he had sexually assaulted people.
And I would say also that the level of expectation of a construction worker versus somebody running for the United States is different. And so I would not expect to hear those types of comments coming from somebody who is to be the president of the United States.
She's definitely wrong about stuff right
there. I'm not wrong about that. Most of my opinion. Wrong.
Was that the first time there was such a sharp line of disagreement on this panel?
Yes, I think the first panel we had, people were polite and, you know.
They're getting used to each other now.
I think they're getting to know each other better, but I also think some of the issues that we discussed last night are more prone to be polarizing. But that, yes, there was sharp disagreement over this whole idea of the moral character of a candidate and whether that should even factor in at all.
Okay. Back to some phone calls here. Casey from Raymore. Casey, thanks for calling.
Hi. Hi. Thank you for listening to me. My concern is, who's running for president? Because so much focus last night was placed on Bill Clinton, not Hillary, Bill. And we aren't hearing a lot of stuff about Melania.
Melania,
who
right.
Like a Barbie doll.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I mean, his whole family kind of looked like the Stepford family. What I want to see happen is respect for women from the top down. And that includes judging a woman based on her own history and her own performance in her job and her own opinions, not those of her spouse. I don't want to be judged based on my husband's performance at work.
Right.
I would like to be judged on my own. And I don't understand the focus on Bill.
Okay. I appreciate those thoughts, Casey. Thanks very much.
Mm-hmm. Bye.
Well, and I think, you know, one of the things coming into last night's watch session was there certainly was a press conference before the camera panned to the women accusers of Bill Clinton. But I think the caller raises a good point, and I think some of the panelists last night agreed that really it's Hillary running for president and, you know, again, not Bill.
And the secretary, she didn't really address the fact those women were sitting up in the front row there, and she didn't really respond to Donald Trump's accusations down that road. She avoided it altogether.
No, and I think that was probably smart, because that would have really taken the debate down a road that would have gone further away from issues and more toward these personal attacks. I do think some of the panelists last night were looking at real manifestations of whether he respected Hillary with some of the comments he was making, like, you know, yes, I'd throw you in jail and that sort of thing.
Okay. Elizabeth from Overland Park, you're on the show. Elizabeth, good morning.
Good morning. Well, Trump says that his nasty remarks on the tape were locker room banter, and the tape was disgusting. But the good thing that came out of this is Trump is the only person who thinks it's banter. Everybody else takes it seriously. And he didn't just say those things. It's clear that he did those things. I think people should look carefully, and not just at Trump, but both the parties. Some people are pro-choice. Other people are pro-life. Well, who's going to give family leave? Who's going to make sure that mother gets good prenatal care and gets a happy delivery and a happy, healthy baby, and that baby grows up to have good child care and good education? I think women should ask very carefully to themselves, do you want to support Republicans or the Democrats?
All right. Elizabeth, thank you.
Well, you know, the points that Elizabeth brought up were brought up by one of our panelists last night. He said, look, you know, people try to make a line of demarcation between Trump and Hillary around pro-life. And they said, well, you know, really, Trump hasn't made visible his stand on pro-life. And they also said, you know, pro-life isn't just about abortion. It's about affordable child care. It's about maternal care. And it's about all the supports for families who need support when they have children.
So at some point last night, Susan, the panel moved past Donald's apology and actually onto other topics, including the Supreme Court picks and vice presidential candidates. Let's hear what was said along those lines.
Joe Gilligan, my general overall was positive towards Hillary's responses. I liked a lot of what she had to say. She seemed much more together, and that she had controlled responses and was like she had real actual plans. But the question about the Supreme Court justices and how specific Trump was about, and Hillary, really, actually, Hillary was specific about what Trump wanted to do with Roe v. Wade and with different other things, brought in things as a Catholic that I have to, like, juggle with. And so it's like all this policy on one side and then Supreme Court justice. And so I don't know that it swayed me at all, because I already kind of knew that was in the balance. But to hear specifics and people on the opposite side saying, like, my opponent is specifically for these things that, you know, I'm not.
Did it sway you one way or another?
I don't think so. Okay. But
Becky Gilligan, and from listening to the last debate to this debate, I know a little bit more about what they stand for by having listened to the vice presidential debate. And as a result of that, I'm a lot more, I would say, more towards Trump because of his vice president than Hillary, because I don't like her as vice president. In this debate, I think Trump was very entertaining at some times. I think Hillary was a lot more strong than last time. I thought she was a bit cocky a lot.
You know, you get the impression this panel is really struggling with some of these things, abortion in particular, Susan. Was it like this with most of the panel last night?
Well, certainly there were people on the panel who still were struggling with the pro-life issue, but other people felt that the Supreme Court nominee was a major factor. Particularly Ina and Craig said, you know what, even though I don't like both candidates, I'm voting for who's going to make the best Supreme Court decision.
That's the big, overarching choice for them.
Yes.
Issue there.
And so I think that will be a break point for some voters in terms of who they might want to vote for.
David from Olathe. David, you're on up today. Good morning. We're talking about last night's presidential debate. Nice to have you.
Yes. People who want to hear candidates talk more about what they're going to do and the issues would be well to remember that many of the things they talk about wanting to do are things they do not have the authority or power to do. And this applies from health care to education to the Supreme Court. Donald Trump cannot appoint people to, like Scalia, to the Supreme Court. He can nominate people. The decision rests with Congress. Education reform is not done by the president. It's done largely at the state and local level. And you can go on down the line. Candidates talk about things that are often pipe dreams, visions, but many of them are things that are not ever going to be within their authority to do.
So their promises need to be kept in context, is what you're saying, David.
Right. It's terrible to suggest to people that I'm going to alter the Supreme Court or that I'm going to fix education. You can take initiatives, but the President of the United States doesn't get to do those things.
Right. David, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Let me go to one more call here, another call here. Pascali from Kansas City, Kansas. Good morning.
Good morning. Yeah, my concern with the videotape is really that we have a man who thinks he's a superstar and tells us that he can do anything that he wants to do. What happens when that man is faced with a real decision to make?
Okay. Yeah, appreciate that. Thank you very much. Let's go to Blake from Lawrence. Blake, thanks for holding on.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Sure.
I've been listening to everybody call, and first of all, it's great you guys are doing this local thing.
I just got, give me 30 seconds worth, Blake. That's all I got.
Okay. Well, I think it was very presidential at the end that both candidates said something great about each other. Although, Bill Clinton is a rapist. Infowars.com. Bill Clinton is a rapist.
Okay, we're gonna cancel that one there. Let me go and wrap up what our panel had to say last night. Give me a sense of how things did wrap up last night, Susan.
Well, I think in general, people were still undecided. And I think, again, the Supreme Court decision would be a major deciding factor. I do think the caller previously who talked about the ability to work with Congress and make things happen was a significant point some were making, because they feel that Hillary does have more experience doing that. Wonder about what kind of presidential temperament that Donald Trump might have, given the way that he went about the debate last night and with the one-liners and the zingers, which doesn't portend a lot of cooperative spirit.
Let's listen to some final thoughts here.
So when they start talking about rules and taxes and loopholes and which are being taken advantage of by one party or another, those are all the laws. And if one party finds a loophole that's an advantage, then everybody's taking that same advantage, really. And so to try to bring that up as a point on either side, it becomes mute very quickly.
Well, I'm still at,
one of the lesser of two evils people, choose your poison. Still not impressed by either.
It's a hard thing to call. I don't know who's going to win the third one. That's going to be very interesting to me. And I just don't know what we as a nation are going to do. We have flawed candidates, but we have to choose somebody. Even though, like you said, it's a hard thing to do, I think Pence would be a really good choice.
So at this point, if you had to vote?
I don't know what I'd do. I probably may flip a coin.
Let me get Nathan from Overland Park here. Nathan, you're on Up to Date. Good morning.
Good morning. It was really remarkable last night that Donald Trump mentioned that he was going to hire a special prosecutor to go after Hillary and her emails.
I don't think I've ever heard that in a presidential debate before. Yeah.
You know, they do it in the arm of the state goes after people in, like, Russia and Venezuela. It's kind of frightening that Donald Trump wanted to do that with Hillary.
Okay. Nathan, thank you for the good thoughts. I appreciate it. Susan, it's sounding like the third debate might be the charm for some of these folks who are still on the fence, and they may not be deciding until they actually walk into the voting booth. That's what kind of a race this is for some of them.
You know, I was really getting that impression. I could really tell that our participants, some of them were really struggling with the whole idea, I think, as someone said, the lesser of two evils, that people acknowledge that probably neither one would be their ideal candidate. But they have what they have. And so I do think there's going to be a lot of weighing of these various pros and cons up into the ballot box.
Susan Wilson is Vice Chancellor for the Division of Diversity and Inclusion at UMKC. She's also a KCUR contributor. And Susan, thanks for the update. This is interesting stuff. We'll come back and do it after your third debate, okay?
All right. It's fascinating.
Okay. Time for a break here. When we come back, we'll turn to some of these controversial ballot issues that Missouri voters will be facing next month. You're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. I'm Steve Kraske. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. On Friday's program, we took a nostalgic look back at the 1980s teen movies and their enduring legacy. You can find the conversation at kcur.org/uptodate. Tomorrow, we explore what it means to be an American now and should the U.S. continue to be the world's policeman. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, Missouri voters next month will vote on a pair of proposals that would raise the state's lowest in the nation cigarette taxes. Also on the ballot, a controversial measure that would require voters to show ID at the polls, similar to Kansas's practice. This morning, we'll kick around these proposals with proponents as well as opponents. Here to help us parse all three of these initiatives is Kansas City Star, Missouri State House reporter Jason Hancock. Jason, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
Let's begin with a cigarette tax, as this first ballot initiative here is Constitutional Amendment 3. It would raise the Missouri per pack tax from 17 cents a pack over time to 60 cents a pack, raising somewhere around $300 million a year. The amendment would create something called the Early Childhood Health and Education Fund. The second proposed cigarette tax increase is Proposition A. It would increase cigarette taxes in stages two, but not by as much. The tax would be up to 23 cents a pack. The proceeds would be earmarked for highways and transportation infrastructure. It would generate around $100 million a year once the tax is fully enforced. Here to tell us about these proposals as well are Ashley Ray. She's manager of tobacco control and lung health at the American Lung Association. Her organization opposes new tobacco tax increases in this case. Ashley, good morning.
Good morning.
Joining me on the phone is Jane Duker. She's of counsel for Spencer Fain. She's a spokesperson for Raise Your Hand for Kids and Vote Yes on 3. She joins us from her office in St. Louis. Jane, nice to have you. Good morning.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for having me.
Jason Hancock from the Star, set the stage for us here. There have been numerous attempts to raise the cigarette tax, which, as I said, ranks in Missouri at least as the lowest cigarette tax in the nation. Why has it been so difficult to get that done?
Well, Missouri is a state that's made up of voters that are none too happy to be raising taxes in any sort of statewide way. So every time that the ballot, they put a cigarette tax on the ballot, it's run into that sort of anti-tax sentiment in the public. It's also run into a fair amount of spending on the other side from cigarette companies and petroleum, gas stations, convenience stores. that have fought this tax off for years. They came really close in 2012. They spent a lot of money. The American Cancer Society was heavily invested, and they came really close to getting it across the finish line in 12, fell a few points short. They're back again this year, and this sort of strange bedfellows of cigarette companies on all sides, the American Cancer Society now in opposition of everything that's on the ballot regarding cigarette taxes. It's anybody's guess what the political dynamic is going to turn into this fall.
So. I was going to say, you do get a sense watching these things over the years, Jason, the cigarette taxes, that the margins of defeat have really grown pretty narrow. And you wonder if something might not pass soon. At least that's been the thinking around the state. Do I have that right?
That's been it has gotten more narrow. They've gotten closer. But again, it's hard to say what sort of, if this election will follow that trajectory, because we've shaken the snow globes up, and now there's people who were spending big money in support of a cigarette tax increase 4 years ago are now in opposition to it. You have R.J. Reynolds spending a lot of money trying to get the larger cigarette tax increase across the finish line, and you have the little cigarette companies spending money trying to get theirs, the smaller cigarette tax done, and in opposition to the larger one. It's just, there's just this really interesting dynamic that's forming. So it's not the same people lining up on each side as it has been in recent years. So it's anybody's guess, I think, as to whether either of these things can get done or how things are going to shake out.
Okay, well, let's get into these taxes here a little bit. Ashley Ray, you oppose both these cigarette tax increases. But how can you oppose them when they would raise money for things like children's health care and highways? Both are pressing needs in the state of Missouri. Where does your opposition come from?
The opposition is coming from the fact that it's an incremental increase, and we see that small incremental changes do not deter overall smoking rates. So we will find the incremental increases over time will not be enough to prohibit youth from initiating smoking, and it's also not enough to get current smokers to stop.
So your objective is to cut the smoking rate down, and you're saying this proposal doesn't achieve that.
That's correct.
Yeah. Jane Duker, you're leading the charge to raise this tax for the larger of the two cigarette taxes on the ballot here. How come?
Well, one, I think we have not made an investment in early childhood education. Right now, Missouri is at the bottom of investing in our early childhood education. 3% of our four-year-olds are enrolled in a public preschool. Oklahoma has 76% of their four-year-olds in early childhood. Arkansas
76% in Oklahoma, Jane?
Yeah, it's
wow.
Humiliating. Yeah, no, it's humiliating. It is that humiliating. Kansas, 20% of their four-year-olds are enrolled in public preschool. Missouri is an incredible, horrible outlier, and it's definitely needed. We obviously need more children's health care. Right now, and by the way, the tax under Amendment 3 will go up to 77 cents. It won't be 60 cents. The increase is 60 cents, but you add it to the 17 cents, so 17 cents. We will still be low. We will only be beating Kentucky and Tennessee after that, but we will no longer be the lowest set cigarette tax in the country. We haven't raised the tax in 23 years. Right now, we spend there's a little bit of wiggle room, but between $40,000 and $100,000 in smoking cessation, even though we take in over $235 million in cigarette taxes currently. Under Amendment 3, the spending for smoking cessation for pregnant mothers and youth will go up to $15 to $30 million. So this is dedicated to smoking cessation programs. Also, it will fund early childhood education and health care to the tune of upwards about $300 million when it fully implemented. And so we are confused a little bit about the opposition, given that there is in no way will it make the situation worse. And, you have to balance what will pass. Lower increases, much higher increases have not passed. This seems to be the sweet spot. And after 2 years of investigating and looking at everything that didn't work over past initiatives, this was the sweet spot. So,
Jane, hang on a second. Explain for me, what's the connection between this Amendment 3 and early childhood education? How much money is being set aside for that?
Actually, 75 to 85% goes to early childhood education.
Okay.
10 to 15% will go to hospitals and other healthcare facilities for early childhood healthcare, and 5 to 10% goes to smoking cessation programs.
And Jane, help me with something else here. Why do tobacco companies then support this tax on their products? What's the thinking there? That seems counterintuitive to me.
Right. Well, from our side of it, it's about closing the loophole. Under the Master Settlement Agreement, the cheap cigarettes.
This is the agreement that the state of Missouri settled on any number of years ago on this issue. Yeah.
And we're the only state in the country that hasn't closed this loophole. And so.
And what's the loophole, Jane?
Is that the small manufacturers, we call them the cheap cigarette manufacturers, do not contribute their fair share to the Master Settlement Agreement. So the state of Missouri is being penalized upwards of $80 million already, and over 10 years will be $1 billion that the state of Missouri will be penalized. That will be money that the state of Missouri will not get because the cheap cigarettes fail to pay their fair share. And so this closes the loophole.
Okay.
And the legislature has refused to do that year after year after year. And so as part of this agreement, when everyone agreed to make all of these payments into the settlement fund that would be distributed to the states, part of that agreement would be that they would make all the manufacturers, in fact, put their fair share in. And so small tobacco, who has lived very comfortably without paying their fair share to that settlement, is now costing. So this is outside of what will be contributed to education and healthcare. This will prevent the bleeding of $1 billion of money that would already be going to the state in the form of this Master Settlement Agreement.
Hang on a second, Jay. I want to go to what the Star's editorial board noted about Amendment 3, came out strongly against it. The measure, the Star editorial board said, is being bankrolled by the parent company of R.J. Reynolds Tobacco Company. It's opposed by the American Cancer Society, as we've already covered here. The Star also wrote this: these groups know that this amendment concocted in Big Tobacco's boardrooms is crafted to increase the industry's profits. They know that there are provisions in this amendment, such as ones involving abortion and stem cell research, that would throw this issue into the courts for many years to come, delaying or preventing any funding that would wind up going to early childhood education and health. What about that?
The profits of Big Tobacco aren't going to get increased. What it's going to do is it's going to level the playing field among all the companies.
Okay.
There is nothing that prevents an increase later. And what I don't understand is everyone wants to talk about motive. I get that, but I read the provisions, and Big Tobacco is going to get whacked. And I, you know what? More cigarette taxes, higher, more. And if we could get that done, everybody would be okay with that. They want to close the loophole. We want to make sure that we fund early childhood education.
And what about the provisions regarding abortion and stem cell research that threaten to throw this thing into the courts for years to come?
Well, I mean, first of all it does is prevent this money, only this money, from funding either stem cell or abortion. That's all it does. It doesn't ban any research. It doesn't hurt any research. It doesn't fund abortions. It doesn't have, there's not one bit of research that anyone has been able to point to that would be halted by this. All we did was put it in here that because there's a healthcare component, that we did not want to make this more controversial, and by putting something in there that would indicate that this could somehow fund cloning, fund abortion.
Okay. I got you.
All of those controversial topics.
Ashley,
and so
Ray,
there's nothing that would stop.
Ashley Ray from the American Lung Association, do you want to add anything more to this?
I do want to add that we've seen before with taxes of this nature that are backed by tobacco companies that they have ways to offset these small incremental increases with coupons and other discounts. So they're essentially not going to be a big change with an incremental rate just like this.
Jason Hancock, how are newspaper editorial boards around the state, beyond what the Star is saying about this, how are they coming down on these proposals? What are you seeing out there?
Well, the most interesting one was the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. There was an editorial, maybe over a year ago, that was in favor of the proposal. A few months later, they flipped on that, and they came out in opposition to the proposal. I'm talking about the early childhood measure now. And just recently, they've flipped again and are now in support. The editorial board was sort of taking it on the chin in a lot of sectors, people who said that, well, they're just going with the last person they talked to is what it seems like. But the way that they said is that they've talked to experts, they've read the proposal, and that they've sort of gotten a clearer picture of what it's going to do. And there is a lot of information out there coming from opponents that try to link it to a lot of hot button issues, whether it be abortion or stem cell research, and to try to drag some of its support down. So, and that's it. The St. Louis Post-Dispatch seems like it's gotten caught up in a lot of that stuff.
Pam from Independence, you're on Up to Date. Pam, good morning.
Hello. Just wanted to make one point and one question. First of all, I'm just in general against tax law being written into the Constitution. It just doesn't feel like that's the appropriate place for it. But second of all, I just wanted to ask for some clarification on the statistics that the lady was quoting about 4% of Missouri children in public preschool versus 70-some-odd percent in other states. And is that public versus total, or total versus total, or public versus public?
Is it apples to apples, I guess, Jane, is what Pam might be asking here.
Yes, and we only have the records of public preschool, because those are the ones that are available from the state, so that's why we need to make sure that, and it's publicly funded. So right now, Missouri does devote about 36, maybe 40 million in preschool, and either public or private, in early childhood services. And this would 10 times the investment. And so we're trying to keep it apples to apples by comparing what the state is already funding.
So the apples to apples comparison, just to clarify for Pam, is 4% Missouri, but 70% in Oklahoma, you said?
76% of four-year-olds are enrolled in a public preschool in Oklahoma.
And that's private and public you're talking about, right?
I'm assuming no, because it's public. It's all we're trying to keep public to public, so it's all public preschool. So that's how we have our statistics. And I understand the reticence about the Constitution, and let me give you just some information on that.
Just quickly,
when we
Jane.
When we did the lottery and we did gaming for education, all that money did in fact go to education. The problem is the legislature backs out the fund and does a revenue swap and decreases their investment in education, and education doesn't net out any better. That we put this in the Constitution so that to prevent the revenue swap that people got so they rightfully get uptight about with regard to the revenue swap on gaming money for education.
I'm going to have to move on. Jane Duker from for Raise Your Hand for Kids and Vote Yes on 3. Thank you, Jane. Ashley Ray with the American Lung Association. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Finally this morning, a look at Constitutional Amendment 6. This would require voters to show ID when they go to vote. It, too, is an intensely controversial idea that has split Republicans and Democrats for years. With us to talk about it is Rabbi Doug Alpert. He's leader of Congregation Kol Ami in Kansas City, Missouri. He opposes Amendment 6. Rabbi, good morning.
Good morning.
Missouri Senator Will Krause also joins us. He represents District 8, which includes parts of Blue Springs and Lee Summit. He's in favor of Amendment 6. Senator, nice to have you.
Hey, Steve. Thank you very much for having me.
Jason, why has this idea been so consistently controversial over the years?
Well, I mean, when you talk to opponents, I think it's a direct assault on the voting rights of a lot of people in our state. And if you talk to proponents, they say that it's an attempt to try to root out and do away with voter fraud. And those are two topics that are going to raise people's temperatures when you're in the middle of a political debate.
Senator Krause, you think showing voter ID is a good step forward. Why do you think it's needed?
You know, if you look in the state of Missouri, you will see that there have been situations where people have tried to change the outcome of elections. You go back to the John Rizzo primary several years ago, where he wins a primary by one vote. 2 years goes by, he's reelected, and then his aunt and uncle plead guilty to voting in a precinct they did not live in. You have to assume they voted for him. So they actually changed the outcome of an election. If you go to St. Louis, there's a place called Kinloch, Missouri, April 2015, 27 people vote from vacant apartments owned by the city. We know they were vacant because the election authority went out and canvassed, knocked on the doors, went inside, things like not running water.
So it's voter fraud that it's at the root of this for you, Senator, if I understand correctly.
Absolutely. I think that, you know, you can see that people are trying to change the outcome of elections, and we just can't verify somebody impersonating somebody else. And that's what photo ID does. we're in the 21st century. You have to have an ID to buy Sudafed.
Right.
So it makes common sense that we should verify who a person is when they come to vote.
Rabbi Alpert, what do you say to that?
Well, the notion, and Senator Krauss represents it like it's a slam dunk to get a photo ID, and that's just not the case. And what this amendment will do, it tries to make something constitutional, a bill passed the Missouri legislature that's really not constitutional. And essentially what it's going to do is disenfranchise 220,000 Missouri voters for a problem that's not really a problem. And particularly it's going to disenfranchise low-income Missourians, people of color, the elderly, who at this point, elderly, you can present an expired driver's license. Under the amendment in the bill, they would have to come up with either a new driver's license or a photo ID, and they'd have to have a birth certificate in order to get that ID, which for a lot of elderly people is very difficult to do. Low-income people who have trouble getting off work, driving to a place where they can get that ID, veterans who can now show their veteran ID wouldn't be allowed to do it under the new bill. So The problem has not been documented. It doesn't really exist. And on the other side of that, you have 220,000 Missourians who now can vote or registered who won't be able to vote.
Senator, what about that disenfranchising nearly a quarter million people in the state? What about that?
We're not disenfranchising anyone. We actually put a provision in this bill. If you show up and you don't have an ID, you can sign a statement swearing that you don't have an ID and get a vote in normal ballot. I mean, we've got provisions in here to safeguard everything. I mean, I think it's disappointing to hear the opposition misrepresent the facts. The fact is, if you show up, you're going to be able to cast a normal ballot. And we'll, you know what we're going to be able to do with this bill? We're going to be able to identify how many people actually show up without a photo ID.
All right. Hang on a second. Alice from Lee's Summit. Alice, you're on the show. Good morning.
Yes, I just want to say that I have worked the elections for over 20 years, and I have never had anybody come in that couldn't vote. And if he wants to do a provisional ballot, does he realize how long that's going to take to do that? Those things take a long time to fill out.
Okay. Rabbi, I'm going to give you the last word here.
Well, and presently, you can, you know, people come in and they do sign an affidavit. So if it's this easy under the bill and under the amendment that Senator Krauss is proposing here, then it wouldn't be any need for it anyway. But that's just not the case. It's not going to be as easy as he lays it out to be.
Will, I got 15 seconds.
This isn't going to disenfranchise anyone. This is going to protect and safeguard our elections. It's common sense. Everybody has an ID these days, and we will provide IDs for anybody that doesn't have them. We pay for the source documents, including birth certificates and divorce decrees, and anything if people need it.
I want to thank Missouri Senator Will Krauss, Rabbi Doug Alpert. Thank you both very much for your time today.
Thank you.
Jason Hancock from The Star. Always appreciate it, Jason. Thank you.
Thank you.
Tomorrow on the show, what it means to be a modern-day American and should the U.S. continue to be the world's policeman. Don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook and this program on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. You can follow me at Steve Kraske. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Coy Duggar, Ryan Hennessy, and Corinne Dorian. Our senior producer is Steven Steigman. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.